now's our time. We're on Cage.
Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and you're locked on to the UK's hottest politics and music podcast. Each week, I bring you the rawest takes on the big stories making the news, always joined by a very special guest. Then, I pleasure your mind, body, and soul with the freshest, most banging international music going.
Uncaged.
Two trailer park girls go round the outside, round the outside, round the outside. Two trailer park girls go round the outside, round the outside, round the outside.
Guess who's back? Back again. Shady's back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back? Guess who's back? Guess who's back? Guess who's back?
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is Sunday the 28th of April, and that can only mean one thing. It's this week's edition of Topple Uncaged. Yes, we love a bit of Eminem on this show, and the song is very fitting because I am back. Some of you may be aware that I'm currently focusing on far more important things than the wobbly world of Westminster. However, I could not leave the only podcast in the UK that brings you the hottest politics and the freshest music alone for too long, so after Easter weekend, I thought, why not launch series 2? If, of course, you want to know a bit more about why I've taken a step back from journalism, you can check it all out on my website. It's www.mrtopple.com. But I think in this world of middle-class voices and establishment figureheads, someone has to be out here telling the truth, and that person has to be me, I suppose.
The parents still listen to Elvis. They start feeling like prisoners helpless. Till someone comes along on a mission and yells, bitch! A visionary, vision is scary. Can start a revolution, polluting the airwaves, a rebel.
And what a couple of weeks it's been since I last spoke to you. I had a fantastic interview with Loki. Brexit keeps rumbling on in the background. Apparently a certain straw-headed man is visiting the UK soon. And Storm Hannah has been ripping across the country.
The center of attention, back for the winner, I'm in a resting. The best thing since wrestling, investing in your kids' ears and nesting.
So to keep in line with the whirlwind that is politics and the weather, we have a whirlwind of a show for you this week. As always, I'll be bringing you the hottest stories in a quick-fire succession on Plucked News. I have one of my favourite journalists from one of the UK's most trusted news sites, yes, The Canary. And we'll be talking about all things that are going on in Turkey and probably touching on the interesting, to say the least, Extinction Rebellion. I'll be hearing your views as always in Twitter chirps back.
Anybody who's talking this shit, that shit.
And I have got one of the most exciting female singer-songwriters to come out of Jamaica this year on the show as well.
You don't know me, you're too old, let go, it's over. Nobody listen to techno.
What more could you ask for on a Sunday morning? So, let's get going.
Suspenseful with a pencil ever since Prince turned himself into a symbol. But sometimes the shit just seems everybody only wants to disgust me. So this must mean I'm disgusting. But it's just me, I'm just obscene.
It's the UK's quickest current affairs roundup. It is Plucked News. Yes, it is the UK's quickest news roundup. It is Plucked News. However, for Series 2, I'm going to take a slightly different slant on this section of the podcast. What I'll be doing is giving you 5 stories from the mainstream media that have been quite widely reported. Then, I will be giving you the 5 angles that they won't be reporting, giving you a different narrative and hopefully some food for thought. So, ping back your luggles. If you're ready, we will get going in 3, 2, 1. And first off, we're up to BBC News, and they reported that Romford Baton arrest, officer investigated by Watchdog. This is, of course, the story of a 17-year-old young man in Romford who was beaten across the legs by a police officer with a baton. Now, this young man had allegedly been in possession of Class B drugs and was arrested on suspicion of drug offences. When, by the look of it, he dared to slightly fight back, this thug in a uniform decided to start beating him. Of course, this has generally provoked a lot of outrage across social media and in sections of the communities, with BAME Lawyers for Justice launching a petition which is attracting a lot of signatures. However, if you want to know what the public really thinks, and also prove why the notion of policing is still such a problem in this country, check out Labour's Shadow Disabilities Minister, Marsha D. Cordova's Twitter timeline. She posted the BAME Lawyers for Justice petition on her timeline, and some of the responses are, at best to say, staggering. One person put, "No, I won't sign it. Don't agree with Child by Media. Wish the PC all the best during this witch hunt." Someone else replied, "Oh, for God's sake, this is why I can't vote Labour. More anti-police rubbish from people who should know better." Oddly, a lot of these people were white. But moreover, it shows there's still this notion that the police are somehow our friends. You try living in a working class community and try being a person of colour and then see if the police are your friend or not. And hat tip to Extinction Rebellion, who've been having for the past few weeks a veritable loving with the Met. You may wish to look across some of the broader communities in this capital to see exactly what the police are really like. Stick up for the police service? I don't fucking think so. And for story number two, I'm off to the Mirror, and they reported that man sleeping rough in bin died after being tipped into rubbish truck and crushed. This is the story of Russell Lane, who was sleeping rough in the bin being consequently tipped into the bin lorry, and his legs were crushed before the bin men realised he was even in there. Now, this story is quite nuanced because Russell was taken to hospital, his legs were crushed, they had to do emergency surgery on him, and then he got an infection in his wounds, and the doctors recommended that he had his leg amputated, but he refused, and he later died in relation to this. Now, the nuance with this story is, Russell was assessed by mental health professionals saying that he was fit to make that kind of decision. He told the doctors that he did not want his leg to be amputated. They said he was fit to make that decision. But by the same token, they say that the infection in his leg happened because he'd been, quote, tampering with his bandages and the clips that had been holding his wounds together. Now, at this point, I want to bring in another story, which I think is also relevant to this. And we're going across to Wales Online, and they reported that hospital patient found dead in shower room 2 days after he went missing from a ward. This is another staggering story within the NHS. This is about Rory McLeod, 52 years old, who was reported missing by hospital staff after he vanished, apparently, in a ward where he was in substance misuse rehabilitation. 2 days later, they found Rory's body dead in a shower room. They hadn't even noticed he was there. Now, an inquiry's been opened and the hospital are going to look into where failings happened and what went wrong, and I'm sure they'll come at saying they learned lessons. But these two stories are innately linked. Firstly, whether you are outside the system, that is with the tragic events that led to Russell's death, or inside the system, where the tragic events that led to Rory's death, people whose society is pushing to its fringes are being failed by the NHS. I can just imagine the medical professional's attitude towards Russell because he was a homeless man, and I can also imagine the same attitude towards Rory because he was an addict. But of course, this poses bigger questions about us as a society, where we are pushing people to the fringes in this way that these tragic events happen in the first place. And for story number three, I'm off to The Guardian, and they reported that Labour lays out plans for social care reform ahead of local elections. Yes, this is the latest pledge from Labour on social care, which they're saying they would provide home help to 160,000 more older people to support them with tasks like dressing, bathing and preparing meals. They'd also make care packages available to at least 50,000 people with dementia, and this still includes the $8 billion they'd spend that they pledged at the last election on social care more broadly. Hurrah! Wonderful! This is great. However, no, let's look behind the headline, and it's not actually that great at all, is it? Because firstly, Labour have made no mention of the fact that where's this social care coming from and who's providing it. It is still private companies that have been outsourced via councils to do this work. So unless you're going to nationalise the care service, you're not really solving the problem, because quite often the care that people receive is absolutely appalling from these companies. But secondly, there's no mention of returning the independent living fund, the thing the Tories axed in 2015. There was a fund for severely disabled people to help them with everyday living and make them independent, give them life within the community and within their own homes. That was slashed, leaving thousands and thousands and thousands of disabled people literally cast out from society, and Labour still have not pledged to bring that back. So, I'm afraid, as always, Mr. Corbyn, with your Labour Party, I'm extremely cautious about this. Yes, it looks good on paper, but drill down a little deeper. Is it all a bit smoke and mirrors? I'm not convinced as yet. And for story number four, I'm off to something called Exhibition World. Yes, exhibitionworld.co.uk. And they reported that Excel London Housing Partnership gets green light. Look, this is another mad story from Labour-run Newham Council, one of the dodgiest boroughs in London, who have signed off on yet another housing development, none of which looks like it's social housing. Obviously, this is Newham, one of the most notorious social cleansers in London. It looks more like another luxury housing development to try and push even more working-class people out of London. Why is the story important, and what is the story that you wouldn't be hearing behind the scenes? Well, contrast that with what's going on in Labour-run Lewisham Borough this time. My mate Ray Walford has been very vocal on this. Effectively, Labour-run Lewisham have signed off on a housing development where there are going to be what are called poor doors. That is, you have a housing development where there's one entrance to it for the rich private tenants and one entrance to it for the poor social housing tenants. Not only does a situation like poor doors and what it represents sum up the whole of London, but it's a disgrace that a Labour-run council is even signing off on the development which has this system installed. There's talk of it being done to a children's playground as well. I mean, it's just mind-blowing. It's absolutely mind-blowing, the situation. And Ray and lots of campaigners in Lewisham, as well as Lisa McKenzie, guest on this podcast before, brilliant working-class academic, they've all been very, very vocal about this. There will be a link to the petition in the show notes. But again, what we're seeing in Newham, what we're seeing in Lewisham, is more social cleansing and more segregation of people from the rest of society. And finally, for story number five, I'm off to something called Pitchfork, a music website, and they reported that Stormzy pulls out of Austrian festival, accuses security of racial profiling. Yes, you may well have seen the story. This is the news that Stormzy and his crew, when they were getting ready for the snowboarding festival in Austria, were effectively racially profiled by the security staff at this festival. His crew were taken to one side and searched for suspicion of carrying weapons, which of course they weren't carrying any weapons at all. Stormzy then kicked off, quite rightly so, I don't blame him, and pulled out of this festival. But what's going on behind the scenes? Let's get over to Twitter and my mate rapper Marcy Phonix, and he tweeted about a tweet that this festival put out. They said, two drink tokens to any member who replied back to this tweet saying something positive about the security, e.g. the security were brilliant or they were helpful, good security, etc. This festival is essentially trying to gloss over the fact that it was extremely racist against Stormzy and his entourage by trying to get people to plant good reviews. They even put in this tweet, need a screenshot ASAP. But once again, what does this show? This shows that certain sections of society are not as entitled to those things as everyone else is, even when you get to Stormzy's level. And I have to say, big respect for Stormzy for having the integrity to pull out of this festival. No respect to the snowbombing festival for having no integrity at all. But again, what it shows is there is one rule for some people and one rule for another. And that, my friends, is the overriding theme of this week's Plucked News. While some people in society can get on, many of us are pushed to the fringes of it. And the results of this are all the stories that I just reviewed in this week's section of the podcast. Plucked News will be back next week. However, now I'm off to chat with one of my friends. Soaring above this week's top stories, I'm free-flying with... Yes, as with Plucked News, my free-flying with section on this week's podcast has had a bit of a makeover for Series 2 as well. Instead of honing in on three news stories, what I want to do with this section is take one story which I feel the mainstream press are missing and that should be amplified more along with the voices involved and give it some of the attention it deserves. So to kick this section off on the podcast this week, I'm joined by a journalist from one of the UK's most trusted news sources. Yes, that's right. The Canary has been rated by NewsGuard, the establishment's way of defining how trustworthy news sources are or not. The Canary has been rated green by NewsGuard. We are extremely trustworthy along with every other mainstream media outlet in the UK. So, quick hat tip to stop funding fake news at this point. And of course, Rachel Riley. Anyway, enough about that. To go through a story which I think should be given more coverage, it is the fantastic campaigner and brilliant editor and journalist from The Canary, Emily Apple. Emily, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
We are going to talk about a subject that you have written about loads, and you are an extremely vocal presence on this topic. I'd love to go into a lot more detail than we are, but it centres around Turkey, and it centres around a hunger strike that has been going on for quite a while now, and it's also gaining traction in the UK. This is a fairly complex story, but I want you to break it down for the listeners at home. So, hunger strike going on in Turkey and spreading to the UK now. What's going on with this? What's the story?
Okay, so Kurdish leader Abdullah Öcalan has been in total isolation in prison in Turkey he's been in prison for many years. He's been in total isolation since 2015. This has meant he is not allowed visits from his lawyers. He is not allowed visits or contact from his friends and family. the conditions he's being held under are against international law, and they're also against Turkey's own laws in how prisoners should be held. So in November, Leyla Güven, who's a member of parliament for the HDP Kurdish party, started a hunger strike. She was in prison at the time. She's now been on hunger strike for over 170 days and is in critical condition. Since she started the hunger strike, thousands of people have joined. Across Turkey, there are thousands on hunger strike, most of them political prisoners. There's quite a few people in the UK also on hunger strike, both in London and Imran Sis in Newport in Wales, who's now been on hunger strike for over 130 days. And what they're demanding is that Turkey respects its own laws, that the isolation that Öcalan is under is ended, he's allowed visitors, and he's allowed access to his lawyers. Now, one of the key things about this as well is that Öcalan is central to the peace process in Turkey and trying to negotiate peace between the Kurdish communities and the Turkish government. And historically, he's been involved from prison in these negotiation discussions. But since 2015, all these have been shut down. And in terms of the Kurdish freedom movement, there isn't going to be peace without Öcalan's involvement. So it's a demand for peace and for working towards peace as much as it is about demanding that his conditions are lifted and that he's treated as he should be.
So this, I mean, this obviously plays into the wider story of the suppression, repression and abuse that the Kurds have had meted out against them by the Turkish regime for how long is a piece of string. I mean, you were in Turkey for some elections a while back, and you also visited Turkey last year again for elections. I mean, when you're over there, you're feeling on the ground about what's happening with this situation. Is there a lot of support in Turkey on the ground for his campaign and his cause?
Oh, there amongst the Kurdish communities, absolutely. It's very, very well supported. The issue with Turkey likes to present itself as a democracy, and it's far from being a democracy. So the last two elections, I went to the local elections a few weeks ago and the general election in June. The majority of the media is controlled by Erdogan, Turkey's president. Journalists who've been critical of Erdogan have been locked up. Turkey's been described by Reporters Without Borders as being the biggest jail for journalists in the world. So there isn't a free press. There isn't a way of getting messages out. Politicians have been locked up. There's MPs who are in prison. There's mayors that are in prison. And then even with the local elections, Erdogan lost in Istanbul and in Ankara. In Istanbul, it's kind of almost that he's admitted that he's lost, but not quite. There's still stuff going on. You still can't say that he's definitely conceded in Istanbul. In several Kurdish regions, they've decided that the mayors that won aren't allowed to take their seats, even though they were approved by the election board prior to the election. But now the election board's saying they can't take their seats, so they're therefore going to give the seats to Erdogan's party, loads less votes. At the polling stations themselves, there's a massive police presence. I went there as a independent monitor to observe what was happening at the polling stations. There's loads of police. In other places, there's village guards. And so there's an atmosphere of intimidation, even just going to vote. And in the run-up to the election, there were raids. It's things like on International Women's Day, women in Istanbul were attacked with water cannon and gas because they were protesting. Just the other day, some of the mothers who were trying to support their children on hunger strike were at the prison. They were attacked by the police. It's a very violent and very volatile situation, and it feels like a country under occupation when you're in the Kurdish regions of Turkey.
Yeah, no, it absolutely sounds like that. And we've had some solidarity being shown in the UK for this as well, haven't we? But that as well hasn't been without its repression either. What happened this week with the Met Police and Amnesty International in London? What was that all about?
Well, a group of Kurdish activists, some of whom were on hunger strike anyway, occupied Amnesty's offices in London. Now, they were there because they want Amnesty to speak up about the way Öcalan is being held and about the repression of the Kurdish communities generally and the prison conditions generally of Kurdish people who are in prison. And Amnesty has been quiet on all of this. They're not making any statements on it. In one thing I saw, they claim they didn't even know that the hunger strike was happening or anything about it. So they've been occupying the offices. And to start with, Amnesty said they could stay, and they were there for one night, and it was, oh, they can use the toilets and stuff, and that was fine. By the second day, people were saying that Amnesty had refused to let them use the toilets, weren't letting them have any access to basic needs. And then last night, so that'd be Friday night, the police came in force, arrested, I think it was about 20 people they arrested altogether, very violently. And for a human rights organisation to be happy and to authorise the police to come into their building to remove protesters who are wanting to have a conversation about human rights is appalling.
It is appalling, and it sums up the third sector and NGOs a lot of the time, sadly, unfortunately, doesn't it, Emily, which we both know and we've both written about before. And on a final note on this story, so that's the brilliant summing up of the situation. What can people listening to this do to get themselves involved and to show solidarity and support here?
So there's several things that people can do. In particular, while I was in Bakur in the Kurdish region of Turkey, people were saying about putting pressure on the European Committee for Prevention of Torture, so writing to them, trying to make them aware and getting them involved, writing to your MPs and trying to get them involved. Also, there's campaigns against people taking holidays in Turkey and boycott campaigns that people can get involved in. And across the country, there's Kurdish solidarity groups that people can join and find out what's happening in their own areas. And finally, the UK government makes a lot of money selling weapons to Turkey. And there's a lot of factories. We can put a link in the show notes to all the factories around the country that are arming Turkey. Shell Collective have done a fantastic map that shows where they all are. So get involved and take action, and especially in terms of shutting down the arms trade, because that is just appalling that we're selling arms to a country that's doing this.
Excellent. Again, something you are really involved in and your work has been excellent on is against the armed trade. So that's a brilliant point. Your knowledge on Turkey and what you've been doing on Turkey has been absolutely fantastic. It's worthy of any outlet on this planet, the coverage you've been given. And I know what personally how difficult the situation was in Turkey at times. So it's sterling work, absolutely brilliant stuff. And thank you so much for taking time out of your busy editorial day as well, because I know you've been working normally the Canary, for coming on the podcast. Emily Apple, for the time being, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Time for you guys to be uncaged, because Twitter chirps back. Right, you lot, it's that part of the show where you get to have your say on the biggest issues of the week. It is Twitter Chirps Back. I've had quite a few comments this week. I'm going to get through some of them, but actually there was an overriding theme with a lot of them. I had Pause Radio, my man in the booth, Gav Pause, who does my sound engineering for me on Topple Uncaged. He said WCA debate has zero coverage on MSM. Not even Channel 4 News covered it. Alex Tiffin, brilliant writer from Universal Credit Sufferer, also said WCA debate. Paula Peters, WCA debate. Christina Kalinen said yes, WCA debate, yes. The work capability assessment debate. This was called by Labour's Laura Pidcock this week, and it was a debate into the Department for Work and Pensions work capability assessment, something that is used to decide whether people are entitled to employment and support allowance or not. Now, the thrust of this debate was obviously to discuss the failings of the work capability assessment. Why is it such a pernicious tool in the Department for Work and Pensions armoury? But moreover, to expose the voices of people who are suffering under this and have been suffering and have effectively been abused by the state. debate. Laura Pidcock and especially Labour's Debbie Abrahams made some excellent points during this. I think Laura Pidcock mentioned one claimant who referred to it as psychological rape. We had Debbie Abrahams read out the names of 27, I believe, people who had died after being told they were fit for work by the Department for Work and Pensions. Of course, but as we know, these figures are a lot more than that. But as I've repeatedly said, and in the same vein as universal credit, the work capability assessment needs to be viewed as a sum of its parts. Essentially, this was put into place by Labour in about 2008-2009, and it was a way of trying to get as many people back to work as possible. It was a response to the financial crisis in part. It is, of course, all part of this broader agenda that we see from the establishment and from the system overall to effectively create an underclass of people and shove everyone else back into as much insecure, precarious, low-paid employment as possible. The work capability assessment is used to push disabled and sick people into as little or as much employment as they can do and throw everyone else onto the scrap heap. It is inherently flawed, and while Labour say they're going to replace it with a holistic approach, we have to stop this culture of disbelief of sick and disabled people. Until the DWP has root and branch reform, nothing is going to change. And the Tories' response, of course, to the work capability assessment debate was just to dismiss it. Nothing will change under the Tories, and in my opinion, Labour's knees still need to up their game on what they are saying they will do. It is still not good enough, root and branch reform, but ultimately we need a system change completely. Okay, so what else were people talking about? Expressionless at Damnation. What a fantastic handle. Expressionless at Damnation. Love that. She said, one, I'm really concerned about the ramifications of the MEP votes and the far right being legitimised further. Yes, we are seeing the rise of the far right across Europe, well, across the world, but most notably across Europe and, of course, in this country. Problem is, expressionless at Damnation, the left are failing to address this properly by dismissing people as fascists and Nazis, every white working class people who has an opinion that's different to yours, you're just alienating them further and pushing them into the hands of people like Tommy Robinson and Nigel Farage. And ultimately, if we don't listen to these people, try and educate them and try and change their minds, then nothing's going to change at all because we will continue to be divided. But there'll be more on that in another show. Expressionless at Damnation also said, number two, food bank rise escalating once universal credit is fully complete. This needs to be recognised. It's shocking now and much more, dot, dot, dot. Yes, I think Trussell Trust came out and said that in 2018-2019, food bank use went up by 19%. But as I said about the work capability assessment, this is all part of a broader agenda. Push all you plebs who can into low-paid, precarious employment, and everyone else is thrown on the scrap heap. And that's it. Tweet will be out next Thursday night for you to join in on Twitter Terps back on the next show. But until then, keep commenting and keep boycotting BBC Question Time. And here's this week's banger in Revolutionary Birdsong. I'm always humbled on my podcast to be able to introduce to you new acts which I think are going to either blow up or who I think are extremely exciting or hopefully will do both. And my guest this week is no exception. She is a fantastic vocalist hailing from Jamaica. She has just done a collaboration with a friend of the Top Lung Cage podcast, I have to proudly announce. She's absolutely sublime. I'm very excited to be able to introduce her to you. This is Ray Nicole. Ray, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm very excited to have you here, I have to say.
Thanks for having me, Steve. I'm excited.
Thank you. You have got this fantastic, it is fantastic, it's gorgeous track out with the incredible Indy Allen, who regular listeners to the podcast will know was on a few weeks ago. Premiered on Reggaeville, no less, yep. I have to say. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's got, you have a kind of, there's a reggae sensibility almost about it. It's got the undertones of reggae, but for me, it was more of a real soul influenced and laced track. You've got Indy's lovely lyrical vocals, come a bit of Sing Jay going on, sort of coming in and out of your absolutely gorgeous sort of soaring vocal, which showcases your new and as yet unexplored for the public talent, if you like. It's perfect. It's a gorgeous, beautiful track, and I can see it maybe having something to do with my wedding at some point, you know, because it's that kind of beautiful beautiful love song. I mean, how did the collaboration with Indy come about? How did you two hook up for this?
Okay, we're both from Montego Bay, which is St. James. So I've known him since grade 8. And we were friends. Okay. Yeah, since 2000, and a very long time. So we've been friends for a long time. And we started at the same time. So we came together in the same class doing music together with Fusion Band at or Phuzzion Fusion. They're the one that produced this track. So we wanted to become an entity at one point. So Indy brought the song to Fusion and we said, look, this is a really good song. We can make this work. So let's do it. And then he gave it to me to perform it. And we've been performing it for years, like a lot of years. So we sat down, as we got older, we sat down together and we looked at how it could be better. And so we spent years just working on it, working. I know it's just finally time to be released, but I'm grateful that Indy brought it to us. And now we can show the world what we did many years ago.
That's really interesting. I'm fascinated by the fact that this has been bubbling away under the surface for years. That's because it sounds really fresh. I mean, there's a credit then to the production and the writing of the song itself, because it sounds completely fresh for 2019. You've slotted in really well to the whole reggae vibe and movement that's going on at the minute. It's perfect. I mean, as I said in the introduction, it showcases your voice beautifully as well. You have a wonderful... I want to say you go from an alto to soprano, and you have this wonderful soaring ability just to move across the octaves, and it's effortless. For me, that's always the mark of a real talented singer. It comes across effortless. Voice is absolutely beautiful. When did you discover that you had a talent for singing? When did that first start for you?
Well, I've been singing for as long as I can remember. 3-4, as long as I could talk, I could sing. Or maybe even before I could form words, I could sing. But I grew up in church. I am a Christian. I go to a Baptist church. So I grew up in church. There's a lot of singing. And I'm still a part of my church. So that's where it started. And my family, they recognized my talent from at a very early age. And so they influenced me to continue in that direction. And so when I left high school, I was a part of the choir in my high school. And I was the president at one point of the choir, and then I left. So I was in a lot of choirs and musical groups when I was in Montego Bay, and then I moved to Kingston to start Edna Manley. I'm very happy that my parents influenced me to do that. That's perfect. And so I started. It started from a very young age, and it's just been a growing process from that. And it's been a beautiful process, I really should say, because you can see your own growth. You know, when you're able to experience your own growth, it's just amazing. It's really exciting. I'm really grateful.
Have you say church is a big influence. Musically, were you influenced by any artists? I'm kind of always a bit, do I ask that question? Because I don't know if it's going to be an insult, because no, I'm an artist in my own right. But so who then influenced you sort of musically and vocally, really?
Well, for me, okay, some people would have their specific influences, but for me, I'm a very open-minded person, and so I look at one person and I find influences from everybody and everything. So I have no one specific person that I'm influenced by, but I'm always listening, I'm always learning, and I'm always trying to put little elements into my own singing style. So when I'm practicing, sometimes I practice something from a specific song that I heard, no matter the artist. So it's just influences from many people. It never stops.
And musically, is your main influence, would you say, reggae, or are there, because like I say, there's a sort of soul feel comes to me from feeling Irie. Is it reggae? Is there soul influences? Are you quite broad with what you listen to?
I'm very broad with what I listen to, but I have to say soul is number one. Soul, gospel, reggae. I think that would be the order. In my opinion, that would be the order.
That's really interesting. But that does come through from the track. Now, a little bird tells me that you also used to be quite a prolific background singer, actually, background working vocalist. I've heard you background for Maxi Priest, nonetheless, which was quite a revelation. But you've also done background vocals a lot of times over the years for Protégé, the Grammy-nominated revival roots artist who was up for a gong for a matter of time. How was that, working with Protégé? Because musically, he's quite, he's fascinating as an artist, isn't he? How was working with Protégé?
Okay, well, I still work with him. It's been 2 years now. It's really good. It's you learn a lot. from him and from his band members, because they've been touring for years also. So it teaches you a lot. I can ask him anything I want to ask him about the music industry, and he'll be more than happy to tell me about it and tell me what is good and what is bad. So the experience is good. He meets a lot of people, a lot of cultures. You get to experience so different food, different type of that. I enjoy traveling with him. It's really a pleasure. I'm extremely grateful for the opportunity.
What can we expect from you moving forward as an artist? Are we going to be having some more soul tracks? Are you going to be branching out into any other areas of music? How do you see yourself showcasing to the world what your music is going to be? Is there a plan?
There's a small plan. I'm still working. It's small, but it's coming. I'm still working on it. But I mentioned Fusion. So I'm a part of Fusion also, by the way. So we do production, and they are producing a lot of music. So I have a song that's coming up with them in a couple of months. It's on a juggling. It's Cherish Rhythm, and my song is Right Words. So that's the first thing that everybody can look out for. I have no idea when the release date is, but it is soon. It's very soon. It's coming, and it's going to be great. So that's next, and I would like to do some acoustic projects. I love acoustic music, and I would love to do acoustic projects. And after that, I just want to keep performing, keep recording, keep writing, and feel out the music industry, because, you know, it changes very rapidly. So that's my small plan.
No, I think it's a great plan. Are we talking an album at some point? Will we be seeing that from Ray Nicole sometimes? Because I want to hear it for one, please.
I'm thinking more of an EP.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I think that would be a really good move. Dropping an EP would be excellent. And therefore, if you're going to do that, hurry up, please. That would be lovely. If you're going to do that, will you please come back on the podcast and tell me about that?
Most definitely. I'll always come back anytime.
Excellent. You are fantastic. Like I say, you have the most gorgeous voice, and you're obviously an extremely talented songwriter as well. But moreover, you're lovely. I like you a lot. It's great. Ray Nicole, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a real treat to talk to you. It's been lovely.
Thanks for having me. Hopefully soon again.
Yes, please. Ray Nicole, thank you. How lovely is Ray Nicole? And how talented is she? She is absolutely fantastic. And here it is, her debut single, which has been promoted heavily by the brilliant Reggaeville. It's featuring the sensational mate of mine, Indy Allen, who featured on an earlier podcast. Here it is, Feeling Irie. This is Ray Nicole featuring Indy Allen, Feeling Irie.
Hey, Mr. Music Man, play your melodies for my heart this time. Sweet company for life. Said you're all I need. You're all I need. Come and play for me. Won't you take my hand? Just take my hand. Get high with me. Fly.
And that's it. Episode 22 of Topple Uncaged is done. I'd like to thank my fantastic guests this week, the indefatigable Emily Apple. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Emily Apple. And the gorgeous, the brilliant Ray Nicole. Follow her on Instagram. It's _RayNicole. As always, behind the scenes, thank you to the love of my life, the gorgeous Nicola Jeffrey. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Nick C. Jeffrey. My man in the booth, sound engineer Gav Pause. Follow him on Twitter. It's at Pause with the Z Radio. And last but not least, my in-house singer. It's Ray Star Music. Follow her on Twitter. It's at Ray_Star113. Cheers to the canary for uncaging me. Don't get swept away by Storm Hannah. I will be back next Sunday.
Uncaged.